From KTOL, I'm Katie Anastas with a look at local and statewide news. School funding was a top concern at a town hall meeting held last night by two members of Juneau's legislative delegation. This week, Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed half of the one-time public school funding increase approved by the legislature. It leaves the Juneau School District with a $758,000 shortfall. Chris Neamey was one of about 25 attendees at the town hall. She's a former teacher with three grandkids. She helps Alaskans reach out to their legislators and ask them to support an override.
It affects the children who are our future in this state, and if they really care about children and families, then they can't not pass it.
Juneau Representative Andy Story acknowledged that an override requires a lot of support. 45 out of 60 votes in the Alaska legislature.
That's a high bar, but I know as we speak, people are burning up the phone lines and working on that.
Even if an override doesn't happen, Story says the veto is keeping education funding in the spotlight. The House Finance Committee will continue discussing a permanent increase in per-student state funding when the legislature meets again in January. Despite the outcome for school funding, Story and fellow Democrat Senator Jesse Keel celebrated several items in this year's budget. Keel called the $7.5 million in child care funding a breakthrough.
That's a tremendous move forward, and I'm pleased to say that in the governor's recent vetoes, he left that money alone. That money is on the books. After COVID, we saw with federal supports going away, child care wages dropping in an industry where you cannot attract enough people to do the work.
The budget also funds inmate transportation to and from Juneau as construction continues at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center. Keel says that will help ensure people arrested in Juneau can appear in court here. There's also $175,000 for a study on how the Department of Corrections can reduce suicides among incarcerated people. Juneau's third legislator, Representative Sarah Hannon, was unable to attend Thursday's town hall. Ketchikan City Council will soon consider whether to renew its lease with the only 24/7 emergency shelter in town, or possibly to change the terms. The conversation comes amid recent public testimony about illegal or inappropriate activity in and around the shelter. KRBD's Reagan Miller visited the First City Haven to speak with staff and shelter users about their experiences.
Zach Merrick was at the shelter Wednesday morning dressed in a brown t-shirt and jeans, watching a movie in the common area filled with recliners and couches. He lost his job in Petersburg. He couldn't find a new one and decided to move to Ketchikan to see if things got better for him in a bigger town, but they didn't.
You find out a lot about a place by how they treat the homeless people on the streets.
Merrick says he's used other shelters in the state, like in Anchorage and also some down south.
I do believe this is the best one that I've ever seen, so.
He says that's because there isn't as much violence and there aren't gangs. He says Ketchikan is doing a good job.
You know, everybody should understand everybody. And if we don't understand everybody, then there's a missing piece somewhere.
But despite that sentiment, local business owners and people who live in the downtown area have come to the city council to complain about illegal or inappropriate behavior from people in or around the shelter. A special session is in the works to give the council room to talk about next steps, whether to move forward with renewing the lease, and if they do, what to change. One council member has even suggested closing the shelter immediately while an audit is performed and said she heard allegations of staff using drugs. Deborah Asper is the chief executive officer of Fair City Homeless Services, the organization that runs the shelter.
Our participants live in a completely different world than what we live in, right? So their survival skills don't include paying bills, and they don't include going grocery shopping. They include defending themselves. And when somebody is living on the streets, they go into fight or flight. And that really limits the ability their brain has to function. So, yes, we do see people getting upset and not knowing how to handle that situation and yelling.
Asper says that drug or alcohol use isn't allowed in the shelter. Those who use those substances will be asked to leave. Anthony Nunley is the security officer at the shelter.
We run a tight shift. If you violate any of the rules, and they're basic rules, you will be asked to leave. And if I believe right, we have a sign upstairs and there's 8 rules that are on it. 8 simple rules. Anybody can do it. They choose, I'm going to say 4% choose not to. Those are the ones that I have to keep an eye on.
Nunley says there's very little activity in front of the actual building. Up and down the street, where he has no authority, is different. But shelter staff can't make anyone come inside or use their services. Edward George was homeless before First City Haven was an option.
It's really nice to get out of the weather and, you know, and have somewhere to shower and feel like a human being, you know.
George is a disabled veteran and says the current location is a game changer for him. It's downtown and connected to the bus system. There aren't hills around that make it difficult for him to get there, especially in the winter. But that could change. Asper, the CEO, says there would be a big issue if the city council wanted to change the shelter's capacity. Right now, the fire department cleared the shelter for 54 beds, and she says they don't fill all of them at night.
I mean, so if let's say that the homeless population is 1,000 people, how do you choose 10 people out of 1,000 or 15 people out of 1,000? You know, obviously not all those people need homes. But that also then creates a more of an aggressive, response from people needing these services.
She says shrinking the services or the capacity will only cause more issues outside the shelter because people won't be able to get the help that they're fighting for inside. Asper says there are at least 818 unhoused people in Ketchikan as of last year. Their public services could change depending on what the city council decides to do. Across the past 2 meetings, there's already been suggestions for changes, like reducing capacity or hours of operation. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Polynesian voyagers left Juna last week to embark on a 4-year journey. They plan to circumnavigate the Pacific Rim in the Hokulea, a twin-hulled canoe. The community of Petersburg is anticipating its arrival. KFSK's Hannah Floor sat in as tribal members practiced a welcome song.
A couple dozen people form a circle in folding chairs at the John Hansen Senior Hall. They're here to practice a song that Diane Benson wrote and gifted to the Petersburg tribe. The song is in Tlingit. The lyrics roughly translate to, "The door was open for us on Tlingit land. Let's gather together." The song is one of welcome, but Benson says it has a deeper meaning as well.
It's a reminder. It's a reminder that it's always been open to us, this world, this Tlingit world and way of being and thinking and enjoying and being community, that is open to us. All we have to do is go in.
Many of the people practicing the song have never spoken these particular words in Tlingit before. That's because state and church policies created a multi-generational gap in languages and traditional ways of life. But Benson says that a lack of fluency doesn't indicate a lack of connection to Tlingit culture.
It's just in a different place and you're finding it again. You still have it in you.
When the twin-hulled canoe makes its way into Petersburg, it will arrive from the north. There will be bonfires at Hungry Point and along the Wrangell Narrows. Kids from the Johnson O'Malley Foundation will encircle the fires, drumming. Victoria Moore is one of those eagerly awaiting the Hokulea's arrival in Petersburg.
Knowing my ancestors have been on that point, welcoming where there's been negotiations and so on, our history. So it's wonderful to be a part of.
Many of those at the John Hansen Senior Hall are young people. Diane Benson says she was struck by how naturally they took to drumming and singing the words in Tlingit.
I was so inspired by their the way they just dove right in and the way that they connected so quickly, that it literally felt like ancestors being present.
Until the canoe reaches Petersburg's South Harbor, drummers and dancers of all ages will continue to practice. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Hannah Flohr.